A pool table, don't you understand? Friend, either you're closing your eyes to a situation you do not wish to acknowledge, or you are not aware of the caliber of disaster indicated by the presence of a pool table in your community. Well, you got trouble, my friend. Right here, I say trouble right here in River City. Why, sure, I'm a billiard player. Certainly mighty proud to say I'm always mighty proud to say it. I consider that the hours I spend with a cue in my hand are golden. Help you cultivate horse sense and a cool head and a keen eye. Did you ever take and try to find an ironclad leave?
Hello and welcome to Unfrozen, episode 122, All-American City. I'm your co-host, Greg Lindsay.
And I am Dan Safarik. We are here with the author of All-American City, Bluster, Boom, and Bust in Wichita, Chase Billingham. He is a professor at Wichita State University, and he has written a book about perhaps one of America's more overlooked cities, and we're about to change that. So we're really pleased to have him here and talk about what's the matter with Wichita.
Well, good morning. Thank you both. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here.
So this is an interesting book. We're looking at a city that I think you've simultaneously identified as both having a unique set of challenges, but also being highly typical of, let's say, mid-size or second-tier American cities in their competition to attract the creative class and other desirables from other cities. It's kind of a witch's brew of trying to be affordable, trying to be hip and classy and have all the amenities and also sustain whatever remains or whatever can be drawn from their existing original founding industrial base. So Wichita has all those things going on. Tell us a little bit about how you happened upon this approach.
I say, I'll just add for context this, Chase, it's fascinating to have you on at this moment because we've had some past episodes about Midwest migrations under climate, but also this latest census data shows that, like, yes, the affordability crisis has reached the point where people are now flowing out of Florida and the Sun Belt and back into the Midwest. And we have folks like our friend Diana Lind arguing that, like, the Midwest will be the new destination going forward. So what can we look forward to in a world of microbreweries, container parks and other sorts of fun creative class things?
I appreciate all of those questions, and I think that you're right that they're all tied together here. I've read some of those analyses by Diana Lind, as well as a recent piece in Governing that came out from Alan Ehrenhold, who's referencing some of that. I think some of that may be a bit overblown, because even in the declarations that they were making about the Midwest future and people migrating out of the Sun Belt and toward the Midwest again in pursuit of affordability, if you look at the data, the data are still showing that migration trends are still heading toward the Sun Belt on average, and growth is increasing in many of the Midwestern metropolitan regions. But I think that they may be speaking a little too soon on the way that affordability is going to impact the redistribution of people across the United States. But to Daniel's question, I think you hit it exactly, that the tension that I'm really exploring in the book is this tension between these impulses that cities feel to try to present themselves as authentic and unique and distinct places in order to compete against other regions for investment, for residents, for jobs, while dealing with a limited set of tools at their disposal to try to increase economic activity and to remain competitive. And as a result of that, because the tools that they often have are limited, and they're drawn from the same set of toolkits that other metropolitan regions are using, what you end up with oftentimes are cities that are mimicking one another and that come to resemble one another in terms of the amenities that they're offering. And so we see a sort of consistent homogenization of the urban landscape, even as cities and their boosters are touting their authenticity. And so that's the tension that I explore in the book. And I use the example of Wichita to look into that, because I think that Wichita is at a disadvantage in playing that game against a lot of other cities that have more going on in their economy and more firepower in terms of playing that competitive game.
Can we ask you to take a moment and talk a little bit about Wichita for listeners? Because, you know, Wichita I find funny because I think a lot of people confuse it with Omaha, or it's just like this sort of like rando cities there in Nebraska, Kansas. So, yeah, give us a potted history of Wichita, at least in modern times, if you would mind.
Sure, and that's a big part of the book as well, is trying to place this city within the context of the region itself, because Wichita is probably never going to compete against San Francisco or Miami or Boston in terms of being a global city. But the cities that it's seeing itself as, seeing as its peer cities, the cities that it really is competing against are places like Omaha, Oklahoma City, Tulsa, Little Rock, Des Moines. And what I'm showing in this book is, even in the context of those cities, what you see is Wichita falling further and further behind. And those cities, you mentioned some of the growth that's taking place in the Midwest in recent years, and you're seeing quite robust growth in places like Des Moines and Omaha, and less so in Wichita, even vis-a-vis those other peers. So what is it that's holding this specific region back? And to your question, I think it gets to the history of this city, and that's a question that I explore in the book as well. Why is there a city here in the first place? It's a very remote location in the Central Plains, in South Central Kansas here. And this city was founded in the early 1870s. White settlers are first arriving in this part of Kansas in the 1860s. And this is a place where you see indigenous tribes that are being forced off the land and being relocated to Indian Territory, which is present-day Oklahoma, and white settlers moving in at the confluence of the Arkansas River and the Little Arkansas River, which are known as the Arkansas River in other parts of the country. The Arkansas River here, where you had plentiful bison hunting grounds and a water supply here. And so that's really where the city first comes from, is as a trading post. And it becomes a stop on cattle trails. It's a cow town right on the Chisholm Trail here. So the city grows. This is much of the history of westward expansion of the United States in the 19th century. And what you have is small cities that are competing against one another, in particular for the location of major amenities, especially railroads. And so cities that are going to be victors in that early competition are going to be the places that attract the railroad. Wichita gets the railroad here. And that's why Wichita is the big major city in this region and not Newton or Park City, Kansas. From there, the city grows in some cases by happenstance. We see manufacturing growth in this region in the early 20th century. And it just so happens that this becomes a place where early pioneers in aviation are concentrating. So Clyde Cessna in particular is doing his work here. And you see the growth of small airplane manufacturers, the Cessna Company, Beech, and Stearman, which is going to become Boeing. And so the reason why you have a major metropolitan region here with hundreds of thousands of people in it, and not a small trading outpost like you had in the late 1800s, is largely because of mobilization for World War II, where thousands of people are flocking to this region to work at the Boeing plant, which is churning out bombers at an amazing rate. And the growth of the city really takes place and booms in the middle of the 20th century as that manufacturing sector grows. And you see other entrepreneurship that's growing up around there as well. So major companies like the Coleman Company, which builds camp equipment and stoves and things. The Pizza Hut is founded here, and other food companies like White Castle. And so there is an entrepreneurial pride in the city in the mid-20th century. But in particular, the city's economy is tied very intimately with the aircraft manufacturing sector. So Boeing in particular is going to be the major employer in the city, along with Cessna and Beech and other aircraft manufacturers. And so the ups and downs of the local economy are really tied to that industry. And as that industry grows, so does the local economy. As that industry falters, of course, so does the local economy. It's really almost a miniature version of Detroit, Michigan, in terms of its ties to this one very important industry. And in particular, in the late 20th century into the 21st century, the struggles that the region's economy has faced have been due to the outsourcing of those jobs, the relocation of those jobs, and the corporate relocations and mergers that take companies like Boeing and Cessna and move them out of town. So when Boeing leaves town finally in the early part of the 21st century, that's a really devastating blow to the local economy. And so even as local leaders are seeing those changes on the horizon, and recognizing that they're going to need to work to diversify the local economy to ensure future prosperity, they also don't want to lose that really, really important economic sector in aircraft manufacturing. So that tension has also been at stake as well, because that again is looking at that tension between authenticity and distinctiveness. What makes this city unique? They call themselves, we call ourselves, the air capital of the world because of that aircraft manufacturing sector, but also trying to be the same as other places and trying to appeal to other companies to move in based upon some set of consumption amenities that we think are going to make this place an interesting place to live. And I think all regions are facing that tension, but this one in particular, with its very specific ties to this one important industry, those tensions have really been exacerbated here.
And there's been several instances, of course, where that industry has been subject to some body blows that have nothing to do with Wichita. 9/11, COVID, and then, Boeing's just own manufacturing supply chain problems, with Spirit AeroSystems being spun off and then spun back in again when it failed to deliver and had several critical accidents related to Boeing aircraft. They just cannot get a break with this industry. But the thing that blows my mind is the own goal of the taxation around that industry. If I get this right, the city has agreed again and again, and this has come up with numerous, this has been up for renewal several times under different administrations, not to annex the territory that includes the manufacturing plants of these companies. And so they can't collect taxes from them. Is that correct?
Well, I'm very glad that you brought up this point because I find it extremely fascinating. I think it might be the most boring part of the entire book, and many people who read the book will find it very uninteresting, but I think it's the most interesting part of the book, honestly. And it's been the subject of a lot of discussions that I've had with local elected officials and local leaders, and I've started a lot of fights about this in the region in conversations in person and online. But yes, we have what are called non-annexation agreements that were agreed to beginning in the 1980s between the city of Wichita and major aircraft manufacturing companies, in particular Boeing, Cessna, and Beech. And so, if you think about what do you need to have a major aircraft manufacturing plant, you need a lot of space. You need a lot of land to have runways and huge hangars. And so naturally, a lot of those facilities were built further out away from the city center on territory in the fringe that wasn't part of the city limits. But like many cities, the city is growing and expanding and sprawling, and the city limits are, this is not New York City. It's not Philadelphia. It's not San Francisco. We're not constrained by land here. There's infinite land out on the fringe, and the city spreads like an amoeba, like many cities in the center of the country do, by annexing new territory. But what you have is, as the city is growing outward toward those plants, you would expect that those plants themselves, which have highly valuable property that could be subject to property taxation, would be annexed as well. But the city government agrees in the 1980s not to annex those properties because the companies are essentially threatening to leave the region if they do so and relocate elsewhere. So those agreements go into effect, and I think they're renewable every 20 years. But what you see is very, very glowing language that comes out of the city council when those are proposed about how great these corporations are for the local economy. And so we shouldn't have to subject these companies to property taxation because they're doing so much else for the local economy, in particular employing tens of thousands of people. And if we were to punish them by taxing them too heavily, we would lose those economic benefits, in particular in the case of employment growth. And, that's a pretty reasonable argument to make in some ways. And the promise of these agreements is largely that this prosperity that these companies ensure for the region is going to continue into the future. And we expect that employment growth will continue as well. What you find is that because of some of the incidents that are out of the hands of local leaders, of course, 9/11, COVID, et cetera, those employment trajectories don't really come to fruition. And so we see employment decline. But then, of course, the argument for maintaining those non-annexation agreements becomes reversed. It's not that we want to reward the companies for their employment growth. It's that if we don't offer this benefit, then the employment declines that we're seeing might become even worse. So the argument is sort of flipped on its head there. And the what's very interesting is that I think other people might find it boring, but what I think is very interesting here is that the districts themselves, they call them industrial districts, are named after the companies. You have the Boeing industrial district that is not annexed into the city. But of course, even after Boeing leaves town, it's still named that. And then they have to rename the Boeing industrial district after the, they just call it the aerospace industrial district when Spirit AeroSystems is spun off and takes over as a supplier of Boeing, and employment is continuing to slide below what it was at the peak there. So these were most recently renewed in the year 2020, I believe. And it's usually simply a foregone conclusion that they're going to be approved. But I started some local debates around that time about thinking about whether we want to reconsider that. And it was a very interesting moment when one of the executives from Spirit AeroSystems went before the city council. And he sounded, I thought, like Tom Hagen in The Godfather, very subtly suggesting that if they were not to renew these arguments, something might happen to the city.
I would say the joke of nice little manufacturing base you got there, shame if anything were to happen to it, kind of plays out.
That's obviously exactly right. But of course, it's very complicated because, you know, one thing I think that surprised me, or that I had to learn about this part of the country that is very different from where I came from, which was Boston, Massachusetts, is that local governance is very complicated and it's very balkanized. So in the city of Boston, you have a strong mayor who controls the city government, and you have and controls the school district as well. And the county government is really only in name only. But here you have separate governments for all of those things, a city government that oversees the city, as well as a county government that has huge influence over what happens within the city, separate government and taxing structure for the school district as well. And all of these entities are taxing entities, but they're also competing against one another in some ways for influence and for control over governance of the region. So it gets very complicated in terms of who gets to make decisions around a place like this, which also, I think, poses a challenge to getting things done.
I could nerd out on local and municipal governance all day, and it is fascinating to see how these questions have played out. In researching Aerotropolis, visiting like places like Memphis, which did not do annexation, and watched employers like FedEx move east immediately out of the city, or like in Louisville, where they did do annexation, UPS, and that those kinds of questions in the mid-sized cities of America are fascinating. But moving ahead, so 9/11 happens, and then the next year, totally coincidentally, do not want to link these two together, Richard Florida publishes Rise of the Creative Class, and economic development strategies start to pivot ever so slightly, at least, from tax breaks and TIFs and these kinds of things for large employers to rethinking of economic development as how do I corral as much human capital as I possibly can? Because the crux of Florida's argument is don't bring the jobs here and the rooftops will follow, bring the people and the jobs will follow. And so how does this logic start to penetrate into Wichita? Because, this is as an aside here, Daniel will find this funny. I was in Illinois, my hometown, last weekend, and went to Frankfort, Illinois, which is basically the southern edge of the Chicago suburbs, where I went with a friend to a new speakeasy that was like, it was like 2010s millennial culture had finally reached the southernmost suburbs of Chicago. I imagine some similar fun tropes are playing out in Wichita. So yeah, what is the litany of sameness and how does this play out, Chase?
It's absolutely correct. And I find it fascinating as well. I remember a few years ago in the local newspaper, in the culture section, there was an article about how this amazing new trend was coming to Wichita. We were getting kombucha. You have to try it. These sorts of things, we're getting something that we've never had before, is always very, very exciting in town. We got a Costco about a decade ago and people lined up. So we're very excited when we get a new consumption amenity in this city. But you're absolutely right that appealing to the people that are sometimes blithely referred to as talent has become a key economic development strategy for regions across the country. And it's really a strategy that is rooted in intentional attempts at gentrifying core areas to attract new residents with certain sets of professional skills. And Richard Florida has really been extremely influential, not just in the writing and publications that he's done, but in active consulting that he's done with local economic development leaders and city governments in trying to help them transform their cities into consumption playgrounds that will help them in that competitive struggle. And that's obviously true, and you can see that in any city across the country, but it's true in Wichita as well. So many of the priorities that we see in the Chamber of Commerce and among economic development boosters have been about trying to promote new consumption amenities, and I detail many of those sagas in the book as well, in terms of trying to recreate the riverfront in downtown Wichita to be more cool, to have more restaurants and shops and dining experiences, to essentially replicate the successes that we had seen in waterfront developments in other cities and in riverfront developments in places like San Antonio. So it's absolutely correct. And many of the struggles that we see have been about what types of incentives can we use to lure a new restaurant or a new convention center, to develop a new convention center. How can we pay for those sorts of things? Just most recently, the biggest triumph that we've seen here is that it was finally announced that we're going to get a Cheesecake Factory here. That's been on Wichita's...
Heavens be praised.
I would say we laugh, but that is a huge deal in commercial real estate circles. Yes. That is like the anchor to anchor if you can get a Cheesecake Factory. Kudos to that developer.
It really is, absolutely. And it's been at the top of Wichita's wish lists for many years. So the Cheesecake Factory is currently under development. And again, it is sort of a sign that maybe Wichita is ready to move into this next tier of cities. But again and again, the struggles to develop many of these sorts of consumption-based amenities are largely about what types of incentives can we offer. And that, again, becomes difficult in a place like this. And we can get into politics if you want to, but in a very conservative region of the country with very strong anti-tax perspectives among the electorate and among local elected officials, it can be very hard to manage that type of strategy while also maintaining budgetary stability to provide basic amenities to regular people.
Can we talk a little bit about some of the string of I'm trying to think of what the best noun to use is to describe this group of people, because they're all a little bit different, but the string of, let's just say, people who have come into town with these winning strategies. Richard Fortle is not among them, but you know, they kind of come in, they kind of blow in. They remind me a little bit of like Harold Hill showing up in River City, trying to sell a bunch of band instruments, and everyone thinks it's the greatest thing ever. And it happens like three or four times. Can you talk about some of these out-of-towners who blow in and think they have the magic wand to fix things?
Well, and part of that is why I was hesitant at the very beginning of our conversation when you were mentioning some of these perhaps overblown claims about the Midwestern resurgence due to affordability. And affordability is a really big deal. But when you see affordability in a region, what that also means is potential easy investment opportunities. And when you look at downtown Wichita suffered like many regions across the country in the middle of the 20th century due to the out-migration of jobs, suburban sprawl, and the creation of suburban shopping malls that took away downtown destination retail. This happened in cities all over the place. But there are fewer and fewer reasons for people to be in downtown Wichita as the region sprawled. And so downtown became very empty. And what that meant was that commercial real estate was very cheap. What you also have as a unique challenge in this region is that at the end of the 1980s, there was the discovery of a massive plume of contaminated groundwater underneath all of downtown Wichita that really threatened the viability of all commercial transactions because the groundwater had to be cleaned up, and it was very likely going to be declared a Superfund site and had Superfund move in to organize the cleanup. But that crisis became one of urban reputation because city leaders were very worried about what the stigma of that label would mean for downtown growth and dynamism. As a result of that groundwater contamination really imperiled the very grand redevelopment scheme that was underway at the end of the 1980s and early 1990s that was led by a very prominent sort of eccentric billionaire named Jack DeBoer, who wanted to fundamentally overhaul the riverfront of downtown Wichita. What you had, though, is as a result of all of this stagnation, is that downtown property was very cheap. Skyscrapers were largely empty and very easy to acquire. And so that's an enticing possibility for out-of-town investors. And at the end of the first decade of the 21st century, you had a group of real estate investors and developers from the Twin Cities who came into town and who were known collectively as the Minnesota guys. And the Minnesota guys came into Wichita and they bought up about a quarter or more of all of downtown Wichita with these promises that they were going to, again, make this the cool next city, redevelop these properties, and spark a new resurgence of downtown Wichita. But they were underfinanced, they were overleveraged, and I think that they overestimated the potential of making this a hip new destination city. They were also, of course, affected by the Great Recession that affected property values across the country, and then they got caught up in that as well. But they did very little with any of the properties that they had, and eventually they got caught up in a string of fraud charges and faced criminal prosecution, and they left town. And that really set back downtown development in this one city for many years. And since then, so we have the DeBoer redevelopment scheme in the 1990s, the groundwater crisis. Following that, we have the Minnesota guys who came into town promising to make this the next destination city. That didn't pan out. And then we enter into the second decade of the 21st century in the fallout of the Minnesota guys scandal. How are we going to once again try to make this region grow, mostly, as you were mentioning, along the lines of a Richard Florida-esque consumption-based scheme to gentrify downtown Wichita and make it a place where cool professionals want to live. And so new consultants are coming in with new ideas. But against the backdrop of all of this, of course, is that this is still a manufacturing-based economy. And there's relatively, you know, we're relatively limited in the degree to which we can steer this ship in a different direction, because we are still so fundamentally tied to and reliant upon that one specific industry, that going from becoming an aircraft manufacturing town to becoming a new tech hub is going to be pretty challenging for this place.
And I think what was also interesting, in the book is that you come down pretty hard on some of the, not just the city fathers, but the newspapers and other media for being so credulous toward these people. My favorite thing was that, you know, for years and years, they followed this guy, James Chung, around, calling him Harvard educated James Chung and like every possible reference. And then you kind of explode his credentials to be kind of a lot of vaporware. Is this guy still around? Like, what happened to him?
James Chung is a consultant who consulted with several cities, in particular with Des Moines, Iowa, in the vein of somebody like Richard Florida in terms of thinking about how to grow. I haven't heard much from him recently. I think that he's got a new venture overseas right now, but no, we haven't heard from him very much in recent years. But it was a very big deal when he was retained by the local community foundation to do research and into what can we do to promote growth in this region. And he really became this sort of oracle who had this very, I would say, mystical power in guiding local economic development region decisions for several years in this region. The media point is very important because, and I tie this to the theories about growth coalitions and what is referred to as the growth machine by Harvey Mollich. and the role that the local media play in terms of boosterism and growth in metropolitan regions. And this is not a new phenomenon. And I talk about the ways in which Marshall Murdoch, who was the founder of the Wichita Eagle, served this role very prominently in the 19th century. The media have always had a vested interest in metropolitan growth. And one of the great insights of Mollich and later of John Logan and Harvey Mollich in the book Urban Fortunes is talking about the ways in which local growth coalitions can set aside political differences on other things that divide them, because they can all come together in the interest of growth and the profitability and revenue that that growth will generate. And the media play a really critical role there as well. So what you find, I don't think that this is unique to Wichita, but again, in the absence of real robust dynamic economic growth, what you find is a sort of patina that paints a portrait of growth in some ways to try to encourage future growth to develop, but also to celebrate successes that might not really be there in reality. And we definitely saw that in terms of credulous coverage of the Minnesota guys in this region. So the media play a very important role, or did, I would say, in the 20th century into the early 21st century as part of that growth coalition, the growth machine. I wonder about how long that's going to be sustained, because we've seen such devastating impacts upon the newspaper industry in recent decades, with local newspapers shuttering all across the country, local newspaper subscriptions really dwindling. I think that the role that the local newspaper plays is very different today and much smaller today than it was in the 20th century. So I don't know if the media are going to be as key a player in those growth coalitions going forward as they were in the 20th century when Mollich was first developing that theory.
All right, so the obvious question I have to ask is how much success has Wichita had? Because it's interesting that, you know, in larger cities, for example, the as part of those gentrification efforts, Marcus Moose at Waterloo has pointed out, like, youthification, like various cities that have succeeded in this have created urban districts that are designed not to ever have families in them, but to, like, simply roll through younger people. So has Wichita gotten younger, even slightly, in that search for affordability? And then the other question I would ask, it's interesting, Wichita sits sort of in this area where multiple cities that have succeeded in programs designed to attract individual remote and hybrid workers. Tulsa Remote to the south, Bentonville did something very similar, the Northwest Arkansas Coalition. Topeka, I remember speaking to the Topeka Chamber, they were doing this too. So there's all these sort of efforts that are happening there to basically hand out cash grants or other incentives to get those people to move. I'm curious if Wichita has ever explored that in the post-pandemic era, because their popularity seems to have taken off with Tulsa Remote's success.
It's a great point. It's absolutely correct that many regions have been doing that and trying to capitalize on remote work as a way to jumpstart that recruitment effort to get people to relocate. You can still work at your job in San Francisco or your job in New York City, but you can live in Tulsa and have a great life at a fraction of the cost. Of course, being able to do that requires that you're going to be able to have the cool bars and restaurants and nightlife and attractions and museums and things that these boosters think young people want to have in order to make living in Tulsa appealing to them. And so Tulsa Remote was a relatively successful effort to try to do that. And you see other cities trying to replicate that as well. I think Topeka just would hand you $10,000 to move to Topeka. So many cities explored that. I think that it's still relatively limited in its effectiveness because Topeka is never going to be New York City. It's never going to be San Francisco. And what a lot of those appeals often succeed in is getting what are sometimes called boomerangs, people that grew up in a region, moved out of town for school or to pursue a career in their 20s, but decide that they want to settle back where they grew up and move back with their families. And you see some of that happening. In Wichita, there have been similar efforts to try to use that strategy to appeal to remote workers. I think that it's less effective today because I think, the pandemic certainly is not as acute as it was. And we've seen some companies that are requiring people to be back at work at higher rates. So I think that strategy is less effective than it might have seemed to be in 2021, 2022. But also, you run up against just that challenge of what do we have to offer here? In the middle of the country, you don't have beaches. We don't have mountains. If you're into outdoor recreation, it can be a challenge. The climate here is very challenging. I was somewhat concerned about doing this interview today because we just had major storms yesterday with lots of tornado warnings, hailstorms. It could be a challenge to live here. But the other piece of that as well is that, in terms of financing those relocation incentives, that money has to come from somewhere. And so getting some sort of coalition of the private sector to finance those sorts of relocation incentives, or using tax dollars to fund a pool to have the public sector fund that, relies upon having either a private sector that's willing to cough up the cash for it, or having local government that is not so pervasively anti-tax that you're able to generate that revenue and apply it. We have neither in this region, I would argue. What you did have, one thing that was offered in that vein here, was an incentive package from the local technical college, which is called WSU Tech, which offered free tuition and stipends to students who wanted to come here and retrain for a shifting economy in the wake of some of the challenges that the aircraft manufacturing industry was facing. But no, there was no robust Tulsa remote type program in this region, and I don't see one coming on the horizon anytime soon.
Well, also with the small cities, you know, it's I've had a chance to visit Tulsa remote, and I know Justin Harlan, who's the director of it right now, and he did tell me candidly that I think one of the biggest reasons that people wash out of the program, those who don't stay, is because of the dating pool in Tulsa. And, you know, it's just the problem of like people used to that larger critical mass.
There was a book that was written a few years ago. I love on this podcast how you list a lot of the texts and resources that are cited. So I wonder if this one will come up on this list. But there was a book that was written a couple of years ago by the comedian Aziz Ansari in collaboration with a sociologist named Eric Kleinenberg. It was called Modern Romance, and it was about dating in metropolitan areas in the 21st century in the US. And one of the metros that was included in that book was Wichita, Kansas. And it was very interesting to see that, as you just mentioned, some of the unique challenges that people who are dating are facing in terms of the limited dating pool in smaller regions in the middle of the country.
That's really interesting. He, by the way, if you say it, it will become a link on our show notes. So it's in.
Well, looking ahead, Chase, what do you think is the recipe for success? Because that gets into a lot of it here. I mean, the critique I've always had of the Florida model is that the electeds who participate in it are basically trying to attract an electorate they want and ignoring the one that they have. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, yes, if you could wave a magic wand over Wichita, what would you do in terms of, like, you know, moving away from its legacy industrial base, but not totally chasing all the current trends? You know, if you did a SWOT analysis of it to leave us on a high note, what are the strengths that, you know, that Wichita should be leveraging?
Well, where I end the book, the policy agenda that I put at the end of the book is what I call somewhat utopian, but almost perversely utopian, because it is about embracing being boring. And what you saw in the early to mid part of the 20th century was that places could be boring and still be places that thrived, where regular people could live and raise a family, have an income, and live their lives. And it wasn't reliant upon having a Topgolf open a franchise in your town. Your economic development ambitions weren't hinging upon that, or about getting a new convention center. It was just about having a stable, regular place where people could live. And so the proposal that I put forward in the book is, how can we return to embracing a boring urbanism? I don't think that any individual city, including Wichita, but also Tulsa or Des Moines or any city, can really do that on their own, because they are all mutually caught in this competition game. And any one city that tries to unilaterally disarm and remove itself from that competition is probably going to end up being a loser. So they have to keep putting up these incentives. And really, it's sort of a race to the bottom in terms of that competitive impulse that really drains a lot of public resources that could be put toward public infrastructure that benefits regular people. So what the agenda that I put up here is about having higher levels really intervening in trying to tamp down that interurban competition. So can we find a path toward greater federal regulation to prevent companies from pitting places against one another in terms of where are we going to site our next headquarters, for instance. That type of competition between cities for attracting the next headquarters really puts cities in a difficult position. What types of federal regulations in taxation or in terms of corporate penalties or in terms of direct investment in cities, like you saw much more in the middle of the 20th century in the era of urban renewal, can we have to try to stabilize municipal finance and to try to tamp down on the sense that local cities have to do it on their own to try to compete against one another to appeal to and appease and attract the corporate sector. Getting away from that model and more toward a model where places like Wichita can thrive while still being pretty mundane and pretty boring is what I'm aiming for. But I say that it's utopian in the book because I think it's going to be a struggle in the current landscape for us to be able to move in that direction.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if cities learn that, you know, that chasing Amazon HQ2 or a Meta back office won't pay off when they have fired all of those employees to rechannel it into their AI budgets.
Exactly right.
One thing that we haven't talked about, we talked about tax policy and municipal governance and some sort of outstanding, you know, characters who have sort of led the arc of development or non-development, as the case may be. We haven't really talked about architecture or buildings, which is interesting. You know, there are a few remarkable buildings in Wichita that people are quite emotional about. And I wanted to touch on those a little bit, and also just to get your general sense, Chase, as a resident and an advocate for the city, when you go around the city, what buildings do you see where you think, oh man, if only a little bit of capital could come in, that could be a great this?
Well, the building, the one specific building that I talk about most in the book is called Century 2, which is the local convention and performing arts center that was developed in 1970. It was an urban renewal project. It was largely federally funded, to come back to something I was just mentioning a few minutes ago. And it was built in 1970 to usher in the second century of Wichita. And it has become this landmark on the city landscape. It is this low-slung dome that is tan granite on the ground floor and with this very light blue dome on top. So it really resembles the Kansas prairie with a blue sky above it. It's quite a beautiful building, I think. But it has been the main performing arts center in the city where the symphony orchestra and opera and musical productions and theater productions come into town, but also serves as the convention center for the city as well. But as you've seen, cities across the country try to redevelop to attract new convention opportunities, redevelop their convention centers and invest hundreds of millions of dollars into new convention spaces to chase these conventions. It was seen that Wichita was falling behind because Century 2 was inadequate to the modern needs of conventions, as well as to the contemporary needs of traveling musical theater productions. And so one of the major controversies that emerges in Wichita, or one of the major talking points that emerges in Wichita with recent attempts to redevelop this property, is that we couldn't get Hamilton. Hamilton wouldn't come to Wichita. And we really, really wanted Hamilton. But Hamilton was going to Tulsa. Hamilton was going to Omaha. Hamilton was going to Kansas City. And there's an inferiority that emerges in Wichita that we couldn't get Hamilton. And it was attributed to the deficiencies of the Century 2 building. And so the most recent major attempt to redevelop the entire core of downtown Wichita was put forward in 2020. It was called the Riverfront Legacy Master Plan. And it entailed tearing down Century 2, which is arguably the most notable landmark on the horizon, on the city skyline. And so this became a major, major controversy. Of course, at that time as well, you had the pandemic, which disrupted all of the convention industry altogether and made us wonder if we were ever going to be able to gather in groups like conventions or go to music theater productions ever again. And you also had a major crisis that affected the city's major employer with the 737 MAX grounding. And so all of those things were combining together and really undermined the viability of the Riverfront Legacy Master Plan. So Century 2 is still there. It still has its deficiencies, but there's, I think we're limited in the degree to which you see major impulse to tear down Century 2 today. So can we reinvest in that structure and make it a structure that is really appealing to the 21st century convention and performing arts needs of the region while also preserving that heritage? In terms of the structures, other historical structures that you were mentioning, there aren't a lot of really notable historic buildings in downtown Wichita, but all of the buildings in downtown Wichita are becoming more and more historic because there haven't been very many new construction projects in the downtown core over the past several decades. If you look at the city skyline today, it looks remarkably similar to what it looked like in 1989 when the tallest building in the city was completed. So I think what I would argue is that what would be a marker of greater economic vitality in the city is if we were to see more new construction downtown and less of a concern for preserving the small number of historic spaces that are there.
Yeah, it would be nice to see that Brutalist Library reactivated too, to do something.
Yes, absolutely. The Brutalist Library is quite beautiful. It's where I got my first COVID shot, actually. And it is a lovely structure. It's modeled after Boston City Hall, which is sometimes referred to as the ugliest building in the world, but I think is quite lovely as well. But it has been largely empty since they built a new library on the other side of the river. And this was part of the Riverfront Legacy Master Plan, was an attempt to redevelop that space along, or tear it down along with Century 2. And since none of that happened, that building has really sat empty for the past several years.
And then I also think a little bit, and you've seen this in many other cities. I lived for a while in Eugene, Oregon, which had a pretty anemic downtown, despite being, you know, an active college town that had a lot going for it. And they did the same thing with these statues, you know, like these 1% for art statues. And in Wichita, they had this particularly sort of like, they sort of reinforced how empty it was because you had all these statues of people doing downtown things, but no people. So it would just stroll past these bronze statues that were just sort of standing sentinel. And, you know, I just think about these other sort of sad, you know, interventions, you know, try to make do with what's there. The one other thing I wanted to talk about was you spent quite a bit of time talking about what seemed like it could have been really successful, but they ended up, sort of own-goaling it, which was this downtown park that was developed. Was it Naftsker Park? It had been, well, describe it a bit for us and then describe what happened to it.
Well, sure. The history of Naftsker Park is really where my interest in these topics began. When I first moved to Wichita, I lived near this park and I would walk around and it was very confusing to me because it's a beautiful space in downtown. It had these brick walls and wrought iron gates around it, winding streams and brick walkways. It looked very, very old. And I was wondering, where did this park come from in the middle of this sort of derelict downtown district? And why are there no people in this park for the most part, except for occasionally some people sleeping in it? And so learning about the history of that park is really where this project began. And then I expanded to learning more about the history of the downtown area in general and the region as a whole. And that's kind of where the book emerged from. But Naftsker Park was designed to look old because it was part of this attempt to create what was called the Old Town District in Wichita, which was not old, but it was created in the 1970s as part of an urban redevelopment scheme. And it was largely funded by urban renewal dollars in the 1960s as an attempt to get rid of what had been there in the past, which was Wichita's Skid Row along East Douglas Avenue on the eastern edge of downtown Wichita. So Naftsker Park was an attempt to redevelop this area to attract the business class back to downtown. But it was a public park. And what it tended to do after demolishing the social service agencies and single room occupancy hotels and other facilities that were catered to by low-income men on Skid Row in downtown Wichita, those people didn't go away. Many of them liked to have a new park in downtown Wichita. And so over the next several decades, this park became a central gathering spot for unhoused people in the city and developed a type of stigma similar to what the Skid Row area of East Douglas had had in the 1960s and into the 1970s. And so you see this, the first time is tragedy, the second time is farce sort of thing happening with Neffskir Park, where the creation of the park in the 1970s was originally designed to attract the middle class. It really failed to do so, not because homeless people were here, but rather because the rest of the economic development engine in downtown, in Wichita in general, really failed to grow in general and failed to attract that new middle class investment. And so what you see in the early part of the 21st century is repeated attempts to try to deal with the problems that are seen in Neffskir Park. And the solution that they came up with was demolish it and build a new park in its place. So the same strategy once again. And so Neffskir Park is still there, but it looks fundamentally different from the original Neffskir Park. You no longer have the brick walls and wrought iron gates and bushes and trees where people could be, but also could sometimes sleep or engage in drug use or other activities that were stigmatized. Instead, you have this flat open space with very few trees, astroturf lawn, and really a very dead space, in my opinion, that was designed mostly to be a front lawn for new restaurants and other shops and amenities that were built on the eastern edge of the redeveloped space in a sort of public-private partnership there. But again, the goal has been largely the same, in my opinion, which is to displace poor and unhoused people from areas of the city that were that local leaders are attempting to upscale. But we certainly haven't solved the problem of homelessness in Wichita. It's largely simply been moved away a few blocks to the north.
Yeah, these cycles are definitely things that you will see in many other cities. It's just, you know, you people talk about the doom loop of San Francisco, for instance, but San Francisco is part of an enormously dynamic, you know, economic region that happens to have a problematic downtown. But just, you know, the amount of money that is circulating in the Bay Area compared to some place like Wichita, it just makes you see how challenging this is.
That's exactly right.
Well, I definitely appreciate that you have a utopian view on this and the glories that are inherent possibly in being boring and simply providing good infrastructure and a good place to live and steady jobs and just leaving it at that. You know, I mean, that would be a huge accomplishment. And, you know, possibly it might even attract some of the things that people ultimately want that make it more distinctive over time. But people don't seem to have that kind of patience or the willingness to put their wallets out.
So have them develop organically. I think that you're right about that.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Chase, for being with us today. This has been another episode of Unfrozen. The book's called All American City, Bluster, Boom, and Bust in Wichita. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Right here in River City. We're the capital T, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for fool.
That stands for fool.
We've surely got trouble.
We surely got trouble.
Right here in River City.
Right here.
Remember the Maine, Plymouth Rock, and the Golden Rule.
The children, gonna have trouble.
Oh, we got trouble. We're in terrible, terrible trouble. That game with the 15 numbered balls is a devil's tool.
Devil's tool.
Oh, yes, we got trouble, trouble, trouble.
Oh, yes, we got trouble. Here we got big, big trouble.
With a T.
With a capital T.
Gotta rhyme it with P.
With a P.
And that stands for pool.
That stands for pool.